reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us for this second oral argument today, a student from Fort Atkinson High School. Would they please stand? Oh, thank you. You may be seated. These students are here today with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. This program invites high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they get materials, generally the briefs of the case, as well as they're doing other activities as the school sees fit. And another component of this program is that they will meet with a justice of this court after this second case. And today you might be joined by students from Barneville High School. So we're delighted to have you with us. And if there are any people here who wish to join in the discussion at noon, you're welcome to come. The issues will be the court's procedures in deciding and hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case. Anyone who wants to learn more about the case can get a synopsis of the case that the marshal will prepare. So just raise your hand and she'll give you one. Those who have the briefs do not need the synopsis. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser, with whom you'll meet at noon. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductions made, I'll call the second case today, Allison M. Whelan versus American Family Mutual Insurance. Arguing for Ms. Whelan is Dennis M. Sullivan. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Dennis Sullivan, and it's a privilege for me to appear before this court on behalf of Allison Whelan, who I'm proud to represent. This case involves the determination of the benefits an insured is entitled to receive under the UIM portion of their auto policy. Although UIM insurance has been a frequent subject for consideration by this court has never been presented with facts like those in this case. The issue on this appeal is whether the policy definition of an underinsured motor vehicle may validly preclude a full UIM recovery for Allison Whelan. The definition at issue here compares the limits of the Whelan UIM policy to the limits of the tortfeasor's policy without regard to whether or not the tortfeasor is liable to more than one person or the amount that the payment actually received under the tortfeasor's policy. It's our position that under these facts, the definition is inconsistent with the recognized purpose of UIM insurance because it deprives Allison Whelan of a fixed level of UIM recovery arrived at by combining payments from all sources, as this court has required for UIM insurance. The definition also acts as a hidden reducing clause, which is prohibited by Section 632.32 sub 5I of the Wisconsin statutes. Brief summary of the background in this case. Allison Whelan was driving her car west on U.S. Highway 29 when she was struck by an eastbound car driven by Elizabeth Brzezinski. Ms. Brzezinski fell asleep. Her car crossed the center line into the path of the Whelan car. Allison Whelan sustained serious and permanent injury. Her medical expenses alone exceeded $180,000. Also injured in this collision was Joshua Opichka, who was a passenger in the Prijinsky vehicle.
Counsel, I just want to clarify that Opichka, which is another case that was consolidated with this case, of course, at the trial level, that Opichka was a guest passenger in the tortfeasor's car, Prijinsky. Is that correct?
Prijinsky, exactly right. Okay. You've got exactly right, Justice. Now, it's undisputed that that Mr. Opichka also sustained serious injury and that he had significant medical expense as well. It's undisputed that Elizabeth Prijinsky's negligence was the sole cause of this collision and of the injuries sustained both by Whelan and Opichka. Now, Elizabeth Prijinsky was insured by a policy issued by Secura Insurance with a single combined limit of $300,000. Allison Whelan was covered by an auto policy issued to her father by American Family. That policy provides UIM insurance with a single combined limit of $300,000. Joshua Opichka was covered by a policy issued by Hastings Mutual with UIM insurance limits of $150,000 per person and $300,000 per accident. After suit was commenced, Secura paid the entire limits of its policy, $300,000, to the court and requested that the trial court allocate that the distribution of that money.
Excuse me, Counselor. Was the passenger limits liability limits or UIM limits for that passenger?
I'm not sure what the liability limits were, but those the limits that I just
the UIM.
Those were the UIM limits.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The trial court, in that case, both Whelan and Opichka made claims under their UIM policies. The insurers moved for summary judgment, and the trial court granted the insurers summary judgment motions, concluding that the Prijinsky vehicle was not an underinsured vehicle, as that term is defined in those policies. And the Court of Appeals affirmed that decision, relying in large part on the Court of Appeals decision in Prafke. Now, all parties have stipulated that Allison Whelan's damages exceed $250,000, that Joshua Opichka's damages exceed $50,000, and that counsel for Whelan and Opichka have stipulated to a division of the $300,000 limits of the Prijinsky policy, $250,000 to Whelan, $50,000 to Prijinsky. So here's our argument. Section 632.32 and the appellate decisions that have concerned that statute and UIM insurance have approved of the limits-to-limits definition of UIM insurance to reduce recovery to the UIM insured by payments from other sources, but only if only under three circumstances. One, the sources are limited to those specified in 632.32 sub 5I, and those payments are made to the insured or to the insured's estate or heirs. And three, the insurance policy clearly states that the insured is purchasing a fixed level of UIM insurance that will be arrived at by combining the permissible sources and UIM payment to reach a fixed level of insurance. Therefore, it's our position in this case that reducing Allison Whelan's UIM benefit by payments made to Joshua Opichka is not permissible because 632.32 sub 5I does not approve of that reduction. And applying the definition of UIM to reduce the benefit to Allison Whelan without regard to the amount that she actually receives has the same effect as reducing the UIM payment by amounts not paid or payable to her, and is therefore a hidden reducing clause prohibited by the statute.
Counsel, is the argument that you just advanced different in any aspect from the decision
the first decision, April 21st decision of District 4?
No.
So their decision tracked this argument in whole.
Exactly. I mean, it is the same.
With regard to the reducing clause, of course, that decision didn't go on to the other challenges that you advance here.
No, exactly right. Exactly right. Furthermore, in our situation, unlike the Opichka case, the American Family Policy uses the words coverage and limits interchangeably, creating an ambiguity in the policy when viewed as a whole. Now, I'd like to focus on the first part, though, because I think that that is dispositive of this issue.
Mr. Sullivan, how do you get around the Taylor versus Gradeway case? It seems to me that that case would lead to exactly the opposite conclusion from the one that you're arguing before us.
Well, the Taylor case did not involve, first of all, it did not involve the fact situation that we have here, and where there are multiple claimants to the same pool of funds available to the UIM insured. In Taylor, the insured there, the UIM insured, collected the full amount of the fixed predetermined amount that this court has said is required for UIM insurance. So, I mean, that's a significant difference. And I think that in Dauhauer, where the court had to confront a constitutional challenge to that statute, the court was obliged to, or whether it was obliged to or not, surveyed the law and surveyed the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage. And in that case said that 632.32.5i and that statute provided that a person who is purchasing UIM insurance is purchasing a predetermined level of coverage against injury sustained from an uninsured motorist, and that the statute established that the UIM limit purchased by the insured is reached by a combination of contributions from all responsible sources. So in this particular case, applying that understanding of the purpose of UIM insurance, that actually applied in Taylor because the person was entitled to collect the full amount of the benefit that was available. I don't recall exactly what the limits were in that case, but it was if the person had $100,000 in UIM coverage and there was $100,000 in liability coverage, they were able to collect a full $100,000.
Yeah, my recollection is it was $50,000, but in any case, the simple-minded approach that I would take here in response to your argument is looking at Taylor. It basically said if you got $50,000 on one side and $50,000 on the other, you don't have an underinsured motorist situation. And here you've got the tortfeasor with $300,000, you've got the American Family Policy with $300,000, and it would seem to lead to the conclusion that you therefore don't have anything inappropriate here, that they're identical in terms of limits.
I think that approach, that argument, which is the argument advanced by American Family in this case, ignores the statements of this court as to what it is that a person is purchasing when they purchase UIM coverage. And I think that the importance of that is underscored just by thinking about a common fact situation. When we get in our car in the morning, and if we've purchased insurance and we head out onto the road, we know, we can look at our deck sheet, we can look at our declarations page, and we know what amount of liability coverage we've got. We know what amount of MedPay coverage we've got. We know what amount of collision coverage, if we've purchased it, we've got. We may look at our UIM coverage and think we have $100,000, $300,000, $500,000, whatever it is, but in fact, we don't know, based on the argument that American Family is making in this case and that the Court of Appeals has upheld, we don't know until we actually get in an accident. and find out how many other people are going to be digging into the pot of that tortfeasor's policy, we don't know how much coverage we have. And that is, that runs absolutely against the statements of this court, saying that a person is UIM insurance is a combination of contributions from all legally responsible sources. It's a predetermined level of coverage against injury from underinsured motorists.
Well, I think maybe you overstated it somewhat, because even though you have liability coverage for $1 million, there are cases that hold you can have several people liable under your policy, and that they share the $1 million. So I buy the policy and I'm the named insured, but we have a case that says, there's somebody else that's vicariously liable. They share it.
That's true, but I think using...
So I don't know that I got $1 million coverage when I go out on the road.
Well, but you know that there is $1 million out there that is available to pay...
A large group. And so you know here there's $300,000 available to pay a large group of claimants, including yourself. And what you don't know is how much the insurance the other guy has, but the policy says... Hey, limit to limit, you're out.
Well, I think the difference, Justice, is that the statements of this court in terms of defining what UIM coverage is and the obligations of insurers in terms of making clear to consumers what it is that they're buying, and the concept that they're buying a predetermined level of coverage. I mean, when they're purchasing that coverage, they're purchasing it for themselves, their family members. They don't expect, and they'd have no reason to expect, based on the decisions of this court, that they're going to have to, in essence, share that pool with people they don't even know.
I want some free legal advice, counsel. Suppose that the victim here... is not a passenger. Well, the other victim, Pitchika, is not a passenger in the tortfeasor's car, but a passenger in Whelan's car, and has no insurance because she's not a driver. Okay. Can she collect under the underinsured motorist provision of Whelan?
Yes.
Why?
Because they're an insured. They're covered insured under the terms of the policy.
I know they are covered insured under the terms of the liability part of the policy. You're saying they're covered insured under UIM?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
I hope your free legal advice is right. I'm teasing. We can go on.
Okay. I think
here's another question. I want some more free legal advice.
Okay.
How much here I am, a jurist from central Wisconsin, married to a lawyer, four kids. How much UIM insurance should I buy to protect myself, realizing as happened with our family? We had a head-on collision. Someone came across the center line and hit it head on. We weren't severely injured, but, God forbid, what if we were? How much, and this person was a 1972 beat up 25,000, minimum limits. How much should I buy to protect this?
Well, the answer, I think, right now, as it stands based on the Court of Appeals decision, is there is no answer. You don't know how much you have to purchase. You don't know. I mean, if you want $500,000 of coverage, is buying $500,000 policy sufficient? Certainly not. Not if you have to divide it with other people who are passengers in the other car, potentially pedestrians who are injured by that same person. $1 million? Now, do you have to buy $1 million in coverage? That's maybe not enough either. There's no way of knowing. This is exactly the problem. There's no way of knowing how much coverage. If you want, maybe you'll figure out how much money, what amount of money you want to actually purchase for coverage. But as based on the Court of Appeals decision in this case, you have no way of knowing whether or not you'll actually ever collect that full amount of money, because it's going to have to be shared with who knows how many other people who could be injured by that tortfeasor.
You're saying that that would be shared by all six passengers in the car?
I don't know. Okay, that is a different situation than I guess the facts in this case are. In other
if
words,
you have the facts of, let's say, foreign, and I use that term guardedly. In other words, not all members of my family in the car, but it's a four-car collision. That might be a different analysis and answer to the question of the Chief Justice.
Right. I recognize that in this case we have two UIM policies. Okay, Opichka's got a UIM policy and the Whelan policy. The scenario that you've kind of talked about here is multiple people making UIM claims under one policy. And in all candor, I don't know the answer to that question. I can see it going different ways, but I have not analyzed that scenario.
Because your analysis is based on the facts of this case.
Of this case.
Which are disparate claimants.
Two different claimants, two separate policies. And in this case, you know, what we're saying is that if you're purchasing that amount of coverage under your policy at a minimum, that is the amount of recovery that you should be able to receive, recognizing that it may come from other sources that are permitted by the statute, the tortfeasor's policy, workers' compensation, other allowable sources. But that at the end of the day, if you've purchased $500,000 in coverage, you've purchased $100,000, whatever it is, you are going to get $100,000 in a recovery. And under this scenario that we're faced with here, you literally have no idea how much of a recovery you're going to get, because you don't know how many other people are going to be making claims against that tortfeasor's policy and how many other people have to share in the amount of the tortfeasor's liability policy.
Let me ask, would you be making the same arguments if you were representing Mr. Opichka?
Certainly. Yes. The difference in the Opichka case is that it does not have, I don't think it does, it does not suffer from the same internal ambiguity that exists in the American Family policy. But in terms of the first part of my argument here, yeah, it's the same.
But in Mr. Opichka's case, he's got $150,000 per person.
Right.
And the tortfeasor had $300,000. You would be arguing still that unless Mr. Opichka gets $150,000 he paid for in total.
If his damages justify that.
His damages. He should get the entire amount. Even though he's much lower than the... I mean, how do you reconcile that with a underinsured motor vehicle?
Because he has purchased a predetermined fixed level of recovery on his uninsured motorist. If his damages exceed that, and if there is not enough money from the tortfeasor's policy to provide him with the predetermined fixed level of insurance that he's purchased from the tortfeasor, his own policy should stand in and make up that difference. I mean, I think that is the teaching of Dauhauer that has been repeated in multiple cases, cases of Badger Mutual versus Schmitz and multiple Court of Appeals cases, all adopt that very fundamental premise that when you purchase UIM coverage, you are purchasing a predetermined fixed level of coverage. I think, quite frankly, in the Dauhauer case, I mean, when I was looking at all of this, I wondered to myself, what if these facts had been the facts in Dauhauer, where there was a constitutional challenge to the statute? I mean, how would that have been different? It's kind of a fun thing to play around with. I don't know what the answer to that is. But I think that it really emphasizes the importance of that particular language in Dauhauer, that a person is entitled to that predetermined fixed level of insurance, that that's what they're purchasing, and that is what the teaching of Badger and Badger Mutual versus Schmitz and the subsequent cases is, that the insurers have to make that clear to the insureds, and particularly in a limits-to-limits recovery, if that's the definition of it, limits-to-limits, that they have to make sure that the insureds understand that figure will be arrived at by a combination of payments from a variety of permitted sources.
So I guess the point is if you hit a school bus and the coverage is $10 million, it's still, I'm talking about underinsured, it makes no difference. The key factor in your argument is that you're entitled to whatever UIM you have purchased, and that is the value. It's a fixed value. It makes no difference what the other insurance is, period.
I think that's the teaching in Dauhauer.
The limit-to-limit policy you advance, I mean, we have Dauhauer, we have Badger Mutual, we have a number of cases, works with regard to one-party claimants, but you're suggesting that it doesn't fit with the statutory scheme when you have multiple claimants. What part of the statutory scheme doesn't it fit with?
Well, it doesn't fit because in 632.32 sub 5i, it specifies what are the permissible other sources of recovery, the amounts paid or payable on behalf of. So to the extent and paying out money to another claimant under the tortfeasor's policy is not one of those permitted sources of recovery. So it is inconsistent with the statute in that respect. The statute is quite clear and very easy to understand, very reasonable, lays out exactly what your sources of recovery, what the other sources are that can be combined to arrive at that figure. This, under that scenario, and given the Court of Appeals decision in this case, you never arrive at that figure. And regardless of whether you call it a definition or if it's in the reducing clause, if it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And the effect of the definition here is the same as if it were a reducing clause.
And the insured's, what you say, reasonable expectations that he or she will receive this amount of money.
Exactly right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kramer, representing American Family.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is John Kramer, and I represent American Family in this case. American Family's position is really very simple. The definition of underinsured motor vehicle that's used in its UIM policy is unambiguous and has been held by this Court to be unambiguous, most recently in Taylor, and as far back as Smith versus Atlantic Mutual in 1990. And all we're asking is that definition be applied as written. When the definition is applied as written, Elizabeth Paczynski's automobile has liability limits that are not less but equal to Allison Whelan's UIM limits, and therefore, by definition, there is no underinsured motor vehicle in this case, and as a result, there's no underinsured motorist coverage available to Allison Whelan. The analysis is that simple.
And it covers the Opuchka case, too.
That's correct. I would point out, I don't know that it makes a difference, but the Opuchka case and the Opuchka appeal and the Whelan appeal were never consolidated and proceeded differently through the Court of Appeals and into this court. So,
but your view of
That would be correct.
Okay.
Would apply the same in our case as the Hastings policy would apply in the Opuchka case.
What about Mr. Sullivan's argument that that would then render the amount of coverage that a person thinks that they're purchasing illusory, in the sense that they don't know what they're really buying? They think they're buying $300,000 worth of underinsured motorist coverage, when in fact that may not be what they're purchasing.
I think what the reasonable person is purchasing is underinsured motorist coverage that has those limits. But the policy tells them that that coverage only applies when they're in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle. And the policy has to define that somehow. And under the more common view or the contemporary view of underinsured motorist coverage, that's a limits-to-limits comparison. So the policy tells them and defines their reasonable expectation of coverage that they will not have UIM coverage unless and until they're in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle. And therefore, just like any other coverage, unless the promissory language is met and the various defined terms are met, there is no coverage available under the policy.
Argument is that nothing in the statute prevents these definitions.
That's correct. And this, the Court of Appeals back in the Crutch v. Hansen case in 1991 and Justice Bradley in her dissent in Taylor in 2001 called on the legislature to come up with a different definition of underinsured motor vehicle, and the legislature has not enacted any different definition. There is no statutory definition of underinsured motor vehicle. And I would point out that with the 1995 legislation regarding UIM coverage in 63232, the definition of underinsured motor vehicle was not addressed, and the reducing clause section cited by Mr. Sullivan only applied to reducing clauses and was in response to a series of decisions from the 1990s that had struck down reducing clauses.
So apparently the legislature didn't listen to me. That's my conclusion, since I asked in my dissent in Taylor that they do that. But so you're saying that this definition isn't inconsistent with the statute. It's not contrary to the statute. The statute and the legislature, the statute does not, there's no statute that defines underinsured motorist. Legislature has not deemed it necessary or appropriate to do so. So we've got a statute, excuse me, we have a definition and a policy. It's clear and unambiguous, and it should be enforced. Let me give you a different definition. I'm going to define, since it's not defined in the statute, I'm going to issue a policy of insurance, and I'm going to define my underinsured motorist vehicle is defined as a white SUV that's traveling within the city limits of Eau Claire on a Tuesday. This is my Eau Claire on Tuesday genre of cases. And is there any legal problem with defining UIM that way? It's clear.
I guess I would have to I would have to see how it's used in the definition and to see if it under what circumstances it would or wouldn't trigger coverage. I suppose if it didn't run afoul of any other statutory provision, while it might be a stretch, I suppose you can define the vehicle that way.
What do you think we would say? That's the case, and here's the seven justices, and you, American family, have a policy that defines underinsured vehicle as a white SUV that's involved in a collision in Eau Claire on Tuesdays. What do you think we'd do with that? How do you think we would analyze that definition?
I think you'd analyze it by finding some real problems inherent in the way that it's described that might create an ambiguity in the policy, maybe an ambiguity in the context of the policy. or perhaps other problems with the way that you've defined it, that then at that point you may be appropriate in examining a person's expectations of coverage. So it would likely suffer from some of those infirmities, and the approach would get to it that way.
You think we'd take a look at the purpose of underinsured motor vehicle and say, you know, we've said in several cases, many cases, purpose is to give a fixed sum, the purpose is to make this person in the same place as though, you know, the underinsured had limits, the tortfeasor had limits like the underinsured limit is. You know, we have that, so we've taken a look at the purpose. Do you think we'd take a look at that white SUV in Eau Claire definition and say, hey, this has nothing to do with what UIM insurance is supposed to do?
I think the analysis would be appropriate in that case, but because I think that you could find problems with the policy language as written, with an ambiguity or something that would get you to an appropriate analysis of the purpose or the insured's reasonable expectations of coverage. So I think, yeah, the court would do that.
But your argument here is, look, the reasonable expectation of coverage, and this is what's in your brief, the reasonable expectation of coverage of the insured is, look at the policy. What does it clearly say? And if it clearly says you have to be a white SUV in Eau Claire on Tuesday, end of story. That's their expectation.
My argument in the policy was something different than the white SUV.
No, but your argument is you don't look at the purpose of underinsured motor vehicle as defined in Badger Mutual or Dahoe or even Seddon Taylor, because you don't need to get to the purpose. You look at the language, limit to limit, end of discussion. I mean, I found your brief very interesting and in some ways compelling because it's consistent from the beginning. It's almost like the beginning and the end of the argument, although you're responding to opposing counsel's arguments, is, look, the language is the language. UIM is not triggered, that's what you say, is not triggered under this language, so you don't have to go anyplace else. Do I misconstrue your argument? I don't want to make it too simple, but that's really what I understand.
You don't misconstrue my argument. I guess I'd like to respond to the point that you raised initially there, and with all due respect, it's very tough for me to respond to the white SUV thing because I think that it's so far afield. What we're dealing with in this case is a traditional definition of underinsured motor vehicle that's been held to be unambiguous and has been held by this court to apply as it's written, to only require an examination of the limits of the tortfeasor's vehicle to the limits of the underinsured motorist coverage. It's a definition that was not affected by the statute. It's a definition that was applied as written in Taylor. It was a definition that the recognized purpose in State Farm versus Langridge in 2004 was said that when you have that definition, an insured, because of its language, because it's unambiguous, an insured ought reasonably to expect that their UIM coverage is going to be the difference between a lower tortfeasor's limit and their UIM limit.
Counselor, so in that definition in the policy, does it say that when I'm reading that policy and I compare the UIM limits with the liability limits, that it doesn't matter how many people claim against the liability limits? Is there any indication that I should consider that when I'm reading the policy?
The definition in and of itself is silent as to the number of claimants, to the payments made under the tortfeasor's limits.
So there's no way that I would know if I read that policy as the person who purchased it that when I'm comparing the limits of liability with my UIM that I'm purchasing, that I might not have available to me the liability limits if there were multiple claimants, correct?
There's nothing in the language of that policy, but I think the conciseness of the definition and the unambiguity of it makes it so that's not an inquiry that needs to be needs to be made when trying to determine if a vehicle is an underinsured motor vehicle.
But that's our problem here, Counselor. And if, you know, if I knew that there were six people claiming against $300,000 of UIM coverage, maybe I'd like to buy more than, excuse me, liability coverage, maybe I'd like to buy more than $300,000 of UIM coverage. I mean, how does the average insured know that that's a factor they should take into account when they're deciding how much UIM to purchase?
Well, the definition certainly doesn't tell them that, but in a very real sense, when I'm buying or trying to arrive at any liability limits under the multiple perils or coverages under an auto policy, be it liability insurance, be it underinsured motorist coverage, uninsured motorist coverage, whatever it is, those are always factors that come into play, and there's always going to be a degree of uncertainty as to how much of a particular limit that's being considered is going to be recovered based upon perhaps the number of vehicles, the number of tortfeasors, the number of claimants under one particular coverage, not just a tortfeasor's coverage, but that could also happen under a UIM coverage if it's triggered and there's an underinsured motor vehicle, or even under UM coverage. So those are all factors, and the policy really doesn't address those, and I think an insured that sits down and goes to the insurance agent and wants to be adequately insured, you can't predict those types of factors. All you can do is buy, you know, the coverage that you can afford.
Well, let me ask this. You talk in terms of the limits to limits. Now, just take a hypothetical policy. $300,000 per person, $300,000 per occurrence. Both the tortfeasor and the other driver had those similar policies. If it's 300 per person and 300 per occurrence, 300 is the max that's going to be paid out. Once the insurance company for the tortfeasor pays anything under the policy to one, another individual, that limits what's left, right? So that if let's say you have three people that are involved and they pay out 100 to two of the individuals, there's really only $100,000 left for that person. Yet the other driver has $300,000 per person in terms of underinsured motorist coverage. Limits to limits. Once the figure starts being reduced, doesn't that affect the limits?
It affects the limits of the of the tortfeasor coverage, but only insofar as what the person is actually going to recover. It doesn't affect the policy limits themselves. The tortfeasor's limits are still, under those facts, which indeed are our facts, $300,000. The definition of underinsured motor vehicle, which tells the insured when underinsured motorist coverage is available, only takes a look at policy limits and doesn't inquire as to what's being paid and what's being paid to whom. I mean, this has been a recognized effect of this particular definition, and this is the way that it's written. Commentators, this court recognized the effect of this type of a definition in multi-claimant situations in State Farm versus Langridge, and said that typically this would not invoke coverage in a multi-claimant situation, recognizing a particular definition of underinsured motor vehicle utilized by State Farm in that case, which contained a separate provision to account for that, would in fact invoke coverage. A company can write to that broadened coverage, but the standard limits to limits language doesn't look at recovery made, but simply compares limits to limits. A person is an underinsured motorist relative to their limits of liability of the two policies, not to amounts recovered.
Counsel, I had such fun in preparing for this case, and one of the things I was able to do is to take a look at the Shermer on insurance, automobile liability insurance, fourth edition, and it's a multi-volume, but this is the volume that deals with what you just commented on. And this volume, when dealing, says what the general rule is. You said the general rule is the I haven't done an all states search personally, so I'm just repeating what this treatise says. The treatise says at 40.11, as a general rule, where the tortfeasor's liability limits
have been split between two or more underinsured motorist claimants, the underinsured motorist carrier has not been permitted to reduce each underinsured motorist claim by the full amount of the other payments made under the liability coverage. The underinsured motorist insurer can deduct only the amount received by each tort claimant. It would be inequitable to permit the insurer to deduct for a tort recovery not made by the particular complainant, and it cites lots of cases. So your general rule seems to be at odds with this treatise's general rule.
I think I'm quoting the statement was, typically with the limits-to-limits definition, that will not account for the multi-claimant situation. Of course, I'm obviously overly paraphrasing, but that comes directly from this Court's decision in State Farm versus Langridge, and that was quoting Attorney Anderson's treating on Wisconsin insurance.
And those cases that were quoted in Anderson's treatise were cases that came from states where the definition of underinsured was set forth in the statutes. Is that correct?
And in those states where the definition is set forth in statutes, those states are utilizing the exact same definition that American Family is using here, a definition validated by this Court in Smith versus Atlantic Mutual, a definition validated by this Court in the very same policy, American Family's policy, in Taylor versus Great Way Insurance.
And
so the functioning of the limits-to-limits definition is the same here under the policy as it would be in a state where this very same definition is included in the legislation.
This premise here and this discussion afterwards in the multi-statute states that I referred to in case law, the premise that they're advancing in this treatise is as a general rule, I'm not talking about where they're defined under the state statute, but as a general rule, it would be inequitable to permit the insured to deduct for a tort recovery not actually made. You are arguing, though, contrary to at least this treatise.
If you're using that as a statement, then I would argue the contrary to that. That is not my belief. I can't comment on what the particular treatise says or the foundation for it, but I disagree with that statement that you made.
Mr. Kramer, believe it or not, we all come here with certain biases. One of my biases is that insurance companies should not be required to pay out damages for things that were not paid for. On the other hand, it seems to me when an insured buys coverage, they're entitled to get what they paid for. And I'm having trouble dealing with Justice Bradley's question about what the most responsible insured does when that insured has a large family or something and goes and might be fairly well to do and buys the $1 million of coverage. I mean, you're not guaranteeing that coverage is going to be delivered, or the equivalent of that coverage is going to be delivered. I'm troubled with that.
First of all, when the insured buys the coverage, they're buying the coverage subject to the terms and conditions of the policy. I mean, if I buy $300,000 worth of insurance coverage, in certain circumstances it's going to be available. In certain circumstances, it's not.
And those limits make perfect sense when there aren't multiple claimants against the coverage. Now, the limits to limits, I mean, just two people are in an accident. You have underinsured motorist coverage. You know it's 300 or 500 or 1 million or whatever it is. It's just one person on the other side. You know that's what's going to be paid out if you can prove those damages. But how do you ever plan for multiple parties making claims?
The only way that you can do it is the way that you do it for any other risk or any other coverage. You just buy the best coverage available under your circumstances, because the result is the same even if it's under, let's say, the UM coverage of a policy and it's triggered, but I have my family riding in my car. Right? First of all, I don't know when my UM coverage is going to be triggered, if I'm going to be better or worse off under it than I would be under the tortfeasor if they were insured. But how much I'm going to recover may in large part depend upon the number of people in my vehicle. Right? There are certain things that can't all, I guess what I'm trying to say is, under any coverage, there are certain things that we can't account for when we're purchasing coverage. But we know that with the limits to limits definition, okay, the purpose of that, when specifically addressing the definition, this Court has said it's solely to put you in the same position you would have been in had the tortfeasor's liability limits been equal to your UIM limits. Well, in this case, those limits are in fact equal, and the plaintiff is in the same position because she's taking under the tortfeasor's limits. So her position hasn't changed. The UIM coverage doesn't promise to give her greater coverage. It just says it's going to put her in the same position as if the tortfeasor had equal limits. In this case, they are equal. So when examining the definition, its purpose is fulfilled, and that purpose comes from the language of the definition itself.
You're really relying on a basic concept in these policies, that your liability, that is the insurance company's liability, is $300,000 come hell or high water. And your policy says we will pay no more than these maximums, $300,000, no matter how many vehicles are described in the declarations or insured persons, claims, claimants, policies, or vehicles involved. So if you got 1 million people in that car, you're only liable for $300,000 under the liability provision, right?
If coverage is triggered and available, and we're looking at the limits of liability, absolutely.
$300,000, so if there's a van with 10 people, your insurance company's maximum liability is, you're going to save $300,000, and those 10 people have to share it, right?
Correct.
And under UIM, you have the same provision. We will pay no more than these maximums, no matter how many vehicles are described, or insured persons, claims, claimants, policies, or vehicles involved. So under underinsured motor vehicles, the policy says, doesn't matter how many claimants there are, the maximum you got is $300,000, and you guys got to share it.
If there are limits available, we're looking at UIM coverage, we're assuming there's an underinsured motor vehicle, if there are multiple people claiming against the 300 limits, that's correct.
Right, so that they don't, under your policy, you don't buy liability for multiple insureds for full coverage, and you don't get coverage under UIM for multiple people.
When we're considering
maximum of $300,000, and you got all divided out.
That's the per occurrence limits, caps it at a certain point regardless of which coverage we're looking
but
at.
But let's take the facts of this case. The facts of this case are, as I referred to earlier, disparate injured parties. Not in the same car, different policies. Why doesn't the simplistic approach of, hey, when I buy liability insurance, I know how much premium I'm paying for what limit of coverage. So if someone sues me, I know I'm protected for, let's say I have $1 million limits. I know I'm protected. They can't take my house. They can't take, you know, up to $1 million. I'm protected. Why doesn't it make sense to say when I buy UIM coverage, I know how much I'm protected for? Let's say my UIM coverage is $500,000. And I pay premiums. I pay a set dollar amount. The insurance company can tell me how much exactly I pay for my UIM coverage of $500,000. So why can't I get $500,000 in this kind of a fact situation with multiple injured parties? Because that's what I paid for. If I wanted $200,000, I'd pay less in premium.
Because that's not what the policy tells you. What the policy tells you is that it will pay you UIM coverage, and that will be available to you in circumstances or when you've been involved in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle. The policy also tells you by clear and unambiguous language that in this particular case, this is not an underinsured motor vehicle because the limits of liability of the tortfeasor are equal to and not less than the UIM limits. To do what you're proposing in that situation is to be using your statement or your expectation of coverage and using it to trump otherwise unambiguous policy language. And the rules of this court and the rules of insurance policy interpretation say you can't do that. If the definition is unambiguous, should be applied as written, and the court doesn't need to engage in construction to determine somebody's reasonable expectations of coverage. That was stated in the Taylor case.
I'll tell you what's bothering me about your argument. If I buy it, Ms. Weiland is in no better position for having paid for $300,000 of UIM coverage than if she'd have paid zero and declined the coverage. She's in no better shape for having purchased it.
She would be in... She has the coverage if she's in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle.
In an accident, she's in no better shape. She doesn't get $1 for that coverage she purchased. That's what bothers me.
But she wouldn't also, let's say that she was in an accident with a tortfeasor's vehicle that had $500,000 in coverage. She wouldn't be in any different position either. I mean, she wouldn't be able to access her UIM coverage because that vehicle, by definition, is not an underinsured motor vehicle. When she pays a premium, or in this case her father pays a premium, they're purchasing underinsured motorist coverage that gets triggered when they're in an accident with an underinsured motor vehicle. But unless and until then, that coverage is not available. That doesn't mean they're purchasing nothing for their premium dollar. That just means it's not available under the facts of this case.
But the $500,000 example that you gave me, she would have available to her $500,000 of coverage, so there wouldn't be any need for her to be paid the $300,000 of coverage that she paid a premium for. Here, she was only paid $250,000, so she's got a $50,000 shortfall that it feels like perhaps she paid for.
But that shortfall, as you put it, doesn't have anything to do with the definition of underinsured motor vehicle or the underinsured motorist policy. It's simply by virtue of the fact that the tortfeasor's liability limits have to be apportioned among multiple claimants. It's a completely separate and independent inquiry from the definition of underinsured motor vehicle.
Well, your response should be that underinsurance is dependent on the comparison of limit to limit, not comparison of what your total damage is are to what you recovered. That's the theme of your argument, isn't it?
That's correct, because the definition is completely silent as to the actual amounts recovered by anybody.
Or the actual damages incurred. You could say underinsurance means that the tortfeasor doesn't pay you fully for your damages, and that your policy should pick up where the tortfeasor leaves off, up to your damages, up to the liability coverage in the policy. But that's not what the cases have said.
That's correct, and I think what you just stated is what is called, I think more recently,
several of the cases have said. Go
the,
ahead.
The earlier, the first view of underinsured motorist coverage is, I think, what you've described there. The limits-to-limits definition is completely separate, and it's noteworthy that in 1990, when Smith versus Atlantic Mutual was decided, that followed only a year after the Korn versus Industrial Fire and the Wood versus American Family cases that found amounts payable language to be ambiguous and went into a whole examination of purposes and expectations of underinsured motorist coverage. And they wanted, in the Smith case and in a case called Kress versus Hansen after Smith, they wanted an exploration of all those purposes to trump the definition, and that was an inappropriate analysis. The definition, the language of the definition is unambiguous. Because it's unambiguous, it's to be applied as written. The court doesn't look to other statements of purpose, its preferences regarding underinsured motorist coverage, and insured's reasonable expectations, because, in a very real sense, the definition of underinsured motor vehicle sets the insured's expectation of coverage. She reads the definition. She knows what to expect. She knows that an underinsured vehicle will be only one that has liability limits less than the limits of the UIM coverage. That then becomes her reasonable expectation of coverage. So what American Family is asking the court to do in this case is to uphold its unambiguous definition of underinsured motor vehicle and apply it as written and affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Buttle.
There's really two points that I want to address. And the first is that it was really a sea change in this whole field after the legislature stepped in 1995 and revised and clarified the statute. And then when this court was confronted with the constitutional challenge to that in Dauhauer, and I think that the court in that case, as Justice Bradley has pointed out, the legislature has declined the invitation on several occasions. They've been requested and have declined the invitation to define underinsured motor vehicle. And I think what that means is that implication of that is that the legislature is content to leave it up to the courts to work that out based on the particular facts that might be presented in any particular case within the confines of the overall purpose of uninsured motorist coverage as defined by the statute and by this court. And given that scenario, one is obligated to look at, in this kind of a case, one is obligated to look not just at the definition that is contained within the policy, but at the statute and the decisions of the appellate courts governing this to determine what is the purpose and what is the meaning of uninsured motorist coverage, and to measure any particular issue as it pertains to that kind of coverage by that standard.
But if we apply that standard, aren't you in effect asking us to overturn Taylor?
Oh, absolutely not. Because in Taylor, the important thing about that case is that the person making the claim in that case wasn't, first of all, the facts in Taylor were not the facts here. You had one party claiming against the other, and it was strictly a matter of looking at one particular policy. That person was able to obtain the full limits of the UIM policy.
Doesn't Taylor stand for the proposition that is opposing counsel's argument? Limits to limits. That's all you look at. You're done when you finish looking at it.
I think that in that particular case, where that was the only issue, that's true, but I don't think that case stands for that you can ignore the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage. All of the subsequent decisions of this court, in particular Dauhauer, which examine the purposes of UIM coverage and whether or not and look to the reasonable expectations of consumers when they're purchasing this kind of coverage. Absent in American Family's analysis of this, totally absent in their analysis of this, is any policy, any public policy justification for looking at it and applying the definition to this particular set of facts to reduce the amount of coverage that's available to the insured. I mean, insurance is purchased by people for the purpose of avoiding risks. And it may be an unusual situation that we're talking about, the school bus or the multiple claimants of the policy, but that's what insurance is for. You shouldn't have to the insured shouldn't have to be the one to bear that risk. That should be a risk that should be borne by the insurance company. They can charge a premium for it. Let me just also make a comment on, because we've been talking about limits to limits coverage, as to whether or not it would make any difference if it's limits to damages coverage. It doesn't, because you can run into the same kind of a situation there. My point is that this isn't really a challenge to the limits to limits definition. That definition is fine. The limits to damages is fine. You can run into the same problem regardless of which kind of coverage you've got, because if you've got multiple claimants against the tortfeasor's policy, the actual damages of the party might be conceivably, and you have damages in excess of a certain amount, but it's less than, you may never collect the full extent of your uninsured motorist coverage because of the application of those definitions. So it really doesn't make any difference if it's limits to limits or limits to damages. You run into the same problem, and the way to avoid that is by making it clear that you cannot reduce the recovery on a UIM, under UIM coverage by payments made to other parties, that it has to be made. You have to conduct that analysis by looking at the amounts paid or payable to the insured and to measure it in that way.
Right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I thank counsel for their argument. That completes 04-AP-1513, Whelan versus American Family Mutual Insurance. Well, for the students here and those from Barneville that may be coming back, we're going to adjourn now, and then Justice Prosser will be coming out or maybe staying here to address you for a few minutes. I'm sure it'll be a very scintillating discussion on what the court does, but as you may recall, the Chief Justice indicated he will not be discussing this case that we just heard. So we're adjourned until this afternoon at 1:30 p.m.